permits are still valid from last time, what are our new requirements, and we'll also be going through and gathering requirements for the next budget preparation phase. So as agencies are going through and using the system, they'll have an opportunity to let us know what would be better for them in terms of using the system. So that's kind of a quick overview from a standpoint of what the budget system is at this point in time. We plan to continue to make it closer and closer to accounting from a standpoint of that connectivity. We plan in the budget execution phase to look at actually tracking e-boards. So as agencies have emergency boards, they'll actually put the information into the system. It'll help in the budget preparation aspect the next time out. And we are working closely with the Legislative Fiscal Office in this whole process. They, for the first time, as Teresa mentioned before, will actually be able to get their hands on the system. In the past, they've had to enter everything they've had by hand. They had to get reports and key information. So there was double entry all over the place from a standpoint of them building their budget as they went through the process. As part of the system, we've developed an extract for them based on their requirements. And the worksheets that they used the last time out during the Ways and Means hearings is actually the model for what we developed the extract to be. So we worked closely with them at that point in time to find out just what exactly they needed from the system. Mm-hmm. So we're working with them now to determine how they'll use it in the next upcoming budget cycle.
So the system is an open architecture system?
Mr. Chairman, the system is a Oracle-based power builder. It is an open architecture system. Mm-hmm. It's any OBDC compliant type of software. I use a little terminology that I don't know necessarily what it means, but you know, it's a term everybody uses. Mm-hmm. But so eventually agencies could use various tools, whether it's Access or Excel or whatever, to extract data out of the database. We haven't set that up yet. Mm-hmm. At this point.
When are we expecting to?
Well, one of the things that we need to do is determine what the requirements are for that, from a standpoint of what data do they need, how we set up the queries, whether we do a data mart, because right now we have our production database, and there's all kinds of questions of whether you let agencies not only use the system online to access the information, but whether you allow people using these other tools to hit the production database at the same time. So there's that kind of discussion that has to take place before we get ready to do that. Mm-hmm. Hopefully we'll be able to do it by, I would say, an August time frame.
Mm-hmm. Well, I do. I think security is a huge issue anytime you have a web-based system of this magnitude. But it's important from a legislative perspective that I kind of teased years ago. When I ran Ways and Means Committee in 1991, it was conflict experiences. And one of the hardest questions I ever asked was, what did you do with the money? Because people had an extraordinarily difficult time answering that question. It really wasn't because they didn't want to. It was because of that really archaic system. And we had a lot of agencies were all accounting for their monies in different ways, and they weren't talking to each other. So you're telling me that we're at a place now where we at least have the capacity to begin to build a conversation between agencies and backtrack.
Mr. Chairman, I believe that with this system and now starting to bridge the accounting to budget, you know, world together, I think you're going to have the budget folks and accounting folks working more closely together to make sure that that data comes across and is easily communicated between the two systems. In other words, accounting data is at a very detailed level, and so when we bring the accounting and compare it to budgetary, we have to roll it up.
Right, but see, from my perspective, you've got to have the ability to logically and rationally backtrack when you're asked mm-hmm. what to some of us seem like very simple questions. It may not be so simple when you start digging into the numbers. If you can do that, then we're miles ahead of where we were 10 years ago. So.
Well, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I invite any of you who are interested in working with us to develop requirements, please let me know, because that's one of the things in trying to develop what it is that we need, you know, we're always looking for information and for people saying, you know, it'd be really beneficial if we could do X, Y, and Z. So that's, I think in the past we've asked, we worked with legislative fiscal office to see if there were legislative members who were interested in working with us. Generally, we've worked with members through legislative fiscal staff.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's probably smart because they can interpret some of the dumb questions we ask. Anybody else? Questions, concerns, comments?
Mr. Chair.
Senator.
We're doing training with people so that they can grasp the concepts of a current level of services. And they're having to extract the information from existing agency budgets and then correlate those with the projections of current level of services. CLS budgeting is something that's been a little vexing for people in the building because legislators, I think, don't have much confidence that they are seeing accuracy in the projections, and it's a bit too arcane for many, including myself, sometimes to grasp. How many states use a current level of services mechanism? It's relatively new in Oregon, although it's one of those things that we wring our hands about and feel captive to. You know, you leave the building with a number in mind. You know the number's going to be bigger when you come back. It seems like alchemy. You come back, your pockets have holes in them. And the question has been, why are we not engaged in a zero-based form of budgeting as many businesses do? So I guess I'd like to ask if we institutionalize current level of services budgeting, what are the implications, and do other states use current level of services type budgeting mechanisms?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Farioli, Teresa McHugh is probably the better person to talk to about policies of how budgets are constructed, as with Ken Rocco. From a system standpoint, we can set the system up to do basically whatever the policy is. And so whether it was zero-based budgeting or whatever, you know, term, we could go with the system. Other states do use a current service level type of budgeting. I couldn't tell you exactly how many, but I know in my conversations with states, they also get into the same sort of, they call it current law, or they call it, you know, different terms, but there, I think the majority of states are also struggling with the same sort of thing, is how do you tell the story of how a budget's put together. But
at least we've gone from the system when Senator Crow was doing this in committee form writing to having a system that is at least flexible enough that if you do change the model for how you do budgeting, you can manipulate it. And
actually, Mr. Chairman, Senator Farioli, I hate to admit that I actually worked in budget management when it was first developed, which was back when Mr. Latimer was the legislative fiscal officer, so
it's, I remember before that.
It's been around for a while. It's changed and kind of mutated or whatever, but it's been around.
Well, we've come a long ways. We really have. I mean, and I mean we've done everything correctly. But I remember making the statement we'd be far better off to invest in file cabinets than we would some of the computer systems, because we had so many computer companies that were competing against each other. And many of those systems were failing, and they weren't doing well. And the Department of Transportation's DMV computer was one of the bigger debacles. But I think we've come a long way where the systems have matured to the point where you can flexibly move them around. So now we've gotten to the point where security is a big issue. All right. Any questions? Concerns? Gerbil? Goodbye. Thank you. Who's next? Who's my next victim here? Steve Buckstein. Yeah, you're the next victim, yes.
No. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you today about, I guess, what's been titled State Government's Appropriate Role and a little bit about alternative ways of balancing Oregon's budget. I'm Steve Buckstein, president of Cascade Policy Institute, based in Portland. We're a think tank, a nonprofit. We work to educate Oregonians about free markets and voluntary transactions that lead to more individual freedom, better economic opportunity, and higher levels of personal responsibility. Since 1991, we've been watching Oregon government and suggesting policies that might better meet the needs of Oregonians. About 2 years ago, we asked Randall Posdina to do some research into the cost of Oregon government services. We wanted to know how Oregon compared to other states and if taxpayers were getting their money's worth. We published his report, which I think you should have in front of you. We should have gotten it at the time. And Oregon tightened its fiscal belt in November of 2000, and Dr. Posdina actually gave a talk about it on Election Day in November, hopefully after everyone had mailed in their ballots who attended that event. Probably most of you know Dr. Posdina. He's one of Oregon's top economists. He manages the Portland branch of the economic consulting firm Eagle Northwest. He's been chairman of the Oregon Investment Council that makes the decisions about who invests the PERS money. Governor Kitzhaber has appointed him to both his Council of Economic Advisors and, more recently, the Oregon Quality Education Model Commission. Before we talk about Dr. Posdina's report, I want to just take a step back and ask a question that he asked when he was figuring out how to look at the information. The question was, can we count on the political process to yield up the right size for government overall? Personally, I probably want a smaller government than most of you on the committee and most of your colleagues. I believe the bulk of what Oregon government does could be better done and cheaper done in the private sector. But the reality is that you've authorized and previous legislatures have authorized certain amounts of money, something like $34 billion in the all funds budget this biennium. And you're doing a lot of different things. I believe that the government's level of involvement in most of those things, most of those programs, is either a historical accident or the consequence of what we call exaggerating the problems of providing those services in the private sector. You can find examples elsewhere in the world where virtually every service that the state of Oregon is doing, for example, is being provided effectively in the private sector. Yet most of us are so used to thinking about major programs like education, transportation, welfare, and others as public services, that we really don't question the role of government in their provision. We don't question the role in terms of funding or in terms of the actual provision of the services, which are two different things. A lot of us, you more than I, sit in this building and lament the high cost and how you can balance the budget after relatively little discussion about whether those services should actually be provided by government. Once government asserts a role in the provision of a service, we rely on that same government, in this case the Oregon government, to represent our interests, the citizens' interests, and keep the costs of those services to a reasonable level. I question whether that arrangement can work over time or whether it has worked very well over time. The discussion of zero-based budgeting versus current service-level budgeting is just one of the issues that comes up in that discussion. A number of years ago, economic Nobel laureate Milton Friedman and his wife Rose made the same argument. They said that there's a natural tendency for government to become too large relative to what they called the consensus level. What individuals might want singly for the size of government, a government program, turns into, through the process, a much larger system. The reason, or one of the main reasons, is that primarily special interests with big stakes in government spending are the ones that can afford to come here and lobby. In contrast, the average taxpayer cannot justify lobbying against those myriad efforts, because their lobbying would cost so much of their time and money and yield so little in savings to them as an individual. A $1 million program that you're arguing about, for example, might be very important to the industry to the company that's getting that $1 million, but for me to come down to Salem and take several hours of my time, even if I defeated the program, might save me 50 cents or a dollar or whatever. It's not worth my time to do it. And so the cumulative effect is that government tends to grow. The predominance of lobbying power among those who would spend relative to those who would rather not spend certain amounts of money causes spending to increase beyond what the economists, what someone like Dr. Pozina calls the efficient level. From this perspective, the ballot measure process, which Oregon is a leader in, can be viewed as a populist check on the tendency of government to grow unchallenged. I think this is why you see most of the measures, not all, but most of them aimed at spending less rather than taxing or doing more. Other democracies rely on the initiative process or the referendum process much more than we do. In Switzerland, for example, everything the legislature does in terms of passing bills is referred to the voters. Consequently, they look very carefully at what they pass. They don't pass very many things, and their sessions, if anything, are probably shorter than yours. One nice consequence of the system is that legislators, again, think very hard about what they're going to do, because virtually everything is second-guessed, where in your case only some of the things are in terms of actually being referred to the ballot. I think that if government was not so easily influenced by special interest politics, we wouldn't need those ballot measures to keep the cost down. But getting back to Dr. Pozina's report, we asked him to benchmark Oregon state and local government spending against other comparable states. He examined spending in all 50 states and the District of Columbia, and let me just summarize what he found. If you simply take spending per capita in Oregon, and this is state and local government spending per capita, we don't look too far out of range. But then when you take into account that Oregon's personal income levels are about 7 or 8% lower than other states, it looks a little bit different. Making only this adjustment, Oregon rose to from about the middle of the pack to about 11th or 12th highest spending state in relation to our income. Since Dr. Pozina's report came out, as I'm sure all of you know, his report was done in 2000. The 2000 census data wasn't available then. It just came out around the end of or the beginning of this year. And we now know that Oregon state and local government on strictly a per capita basis is about the eighth highest spending state in the country. Public spending by its very nature, the spending that you're authorizing, is affected by the demographics of the state, or the demographics of the population that you're working with. The ideal level of education spending per capita, for example, is likely to be very different in a state with a high proportion of young people, say Utah, as opposed to a state with a high proportion of elderly, such as Florida. Oregon cannot be benchmarked to other states without considering those kind of factors. It turns out from Dr. Pozina's research that Oregon is actually very different from other states in a number of ways that may be relevant to different program spending levels. I'll just mention several of them that he looked at. The proportion of Oregonians living in non-metropolitan areas is 50% greater than the national average. The rate of foreign immigration is 33% lower than the national average. Average wages, average annual wages and salaries in Oregon are the nation's 22nd lowest. Oregon's minority population is 64% lower than the national average. Poverty rate is 18% higher than the national average. Oregon also has significantly more participation in the labor force by females than the nation as a whole, and it has a lower smoking rate, which I hadn't realized until he did. When you control for those factors, what he found was that Oregon state and local governments are spending about 15-20% more per capita than other states for comparable services. In other words, if the average U.S. state had Oregon's demographic makeup, it would be spending roughly 15-20% less than we are.
Is that just state spending? Or
no, state and local.
State and local.
Right. And realizing, of course, a lot of the local spending comes, the funds come from the state. It's all state and local government spending.
I saw a review of that recently that indicated, Mr. Chair, that one of the reasons that we register that highly is that Oregon does something that other states will not do, and that's to within its budget, spend federal money. And so federal money is counted that other states don't count, and they might be higher if they counted the federal money that we spend. For instance, in our human resources budget, 80% is
so the federal money would be off balance.
Yeah, and so I don't know whether that's a valid thing, but it certainly was mentioned as one of the explanations of why it is that we're so high. Of course, we fund a lot of things by fees as well. Our tax rate's down about 44th or something like that, state and local tax tax as compared to other states and so forth. But our spending is at 8, as you've indicated, but there are explanations for that in terms of what other kinds of things we spend. And if federal money is if we spend it through our budgets, as we do, I've been on Ways and Means, and I know we spend federal dollars clearly in our budget, and if other states don't record those, then they're spending more.
I'm pretty sure that Dr. Posadina accounted for the federal federal dollars. Your other point was, Senator,
that we fund a lot of things with fees, and we also have a lottery.
Right, and again, when a fee is on a non-competitive service, it looks very much like a tax. For example, this isn't a fee, but the lottery, for example, a lot of people will argue it's not a tax, but it really is a tax because you prohibit private parties, other parties, from providing lottery services, and if you did, you wouldn't see that many people playing the Oregon Lottery because the odds are not nearly as good as a private lottery or private gambling facility might provide. So the fees, unless it's on a really competitive service, look very much like a tax. But again, those are intricacies, yes, you're right, that we can debate. I think just to put a number on it, and again, very, very broad, 15% of the general fund budget is around $1.8 billion. 15% of the all funds budget is about $5 billion. And again, a lot of the federal money, I think, is more in the all funds budget, as I understand it. So if you're just looking at the general fund, if we are 15% higher, that's about $1.8 billion. Dr. Posadina, drill down into several of the major programs that state and local government provide in Oregon, five of them, which account for the vast majority of that spending. You found that when you broke it down by programs that were about 14% more costly in education from kindergarten through higher education, about 30% more costly in health care, 13% more in welfare, 19% more in corrections and police. And of those five areas, the only one that we are less expensive in, based on his analysis, is highway transportation. We're about 3% below the national average after factoring out the demographics. I think when he looked at what caused some of these things, it was explicit policies that were voted on either by the legislature or by voters in initiatives. The Oregon Health Plan, for example, was adopted specifically with the goal of providing health insurance to more Oregonians. It would make sense that, you know, it's going to cost money. We made K-12 education spending the responsibility of state government back when Measure 5 was passed, which was the citizens doing it, and that was before Cascade Policy Institute was formed. I was a supporter of Measure 5, but I think that the part of it that concentrated spending for education at the state level was probably a mistake. It led to, I think, some unintended consequences.
But that, since it's state and local, we're 14% higher on a per capita basis for both state and local revenues.
Yes.
That really doesn't.
Well, over two thirds, I guess now, of K-12 funding comes from the state.
Right, but that doesn't really affect Measure 5. Had no effect on that per se, because that's shifted the funding.
Yes, but and I'll get into this a little bit later. But when you have a concentrated source of funding, it's easier to raise that funding than when it's spread out in many different places. So it's not just coming from a different pot. The pot actually is easier to get larger when it's concentrated.
Now, I've actually given some thought to the idea of advancing, giving these monies to the counties in block grants for education.
Beat me to it.
And let the counties have to figure out how to spend it locally, whether it's in their schools or their health programs or corrections or whatever. Senator?
Mr. Chair, actually, I was having those same thoughts, but my instead would do the other way around, is that we fund schools at the state level because we have a constitutional obligation to do that, and basically devolve human services programs to the counties and to the locals. And Multnomah County, in essence, we're already doing that. We send about $500 million to Multnomah County for a variety of services, and the county bears the responsibility. So
I think we need to do that because doesn't the federal government require a single agency to receive federal money? Is the most
important? I don't know. But it goes, you can walk them through any number of programs in the county, and Multnomah County is delivering those services. So
I just thought about it from an accountability perspective, that if you had your local county commission you could fight with as opposed to us.
Well, and Mr. Chair, that's the other issue now, that we send X amount of dollars to all of our counties. What kind of accountability do we have for it?
That's a tough question.
One of the other, sticking on education for a minute, one of the other reasons for larger spending in K through higher education is that Oregon has a larger proportion of its students enrolled in public versus private colleges, and we subsidize student tuition in those public colleges and universities to a greater extent than other states. In corrections, we voted, as you all know, for more certain and longer prison sentences, which from the citizen standpoint is a good thing. That's led to higher costs in corrections, although Dr. Posdina found that it didn't lead to correspondingly lower crime rates that you would expect to happen, although the data is relatively early since those more certain sentences are relatively new. In the case of highways, underspending in this area, he believed, echoed Oregon's anti-automobile attitudes, and our planners telling us that we can, in his words, be happy living stacked like cordwood within tight urban growth boundaries. And those of us that are in those tight urban growth boundaries, some of us don't care for it too much, but basically there's a concerted effort to reduce use of highways to try and get people into public transportation for good or bad, but has resulted in Oregon spending less on highway transportation. I think when you look at the results, and again, we're spending, again, coming back to education, for example, we're, in his view, clearly spending more per capita on education, but I think we have to question what we're getting for that spending. For example, our kids do very well on the SAT scores. We're oftentimes number one in SATs, but we also have one of the highest dropout rates. So who is actually taking the SAT? And when you read comments from principals like I have in the Portland area, that they discourage certain students from taking the SAT because it will bring down the average score of their school, you begin to wonder, you know, who it's really for. The RAND Corporation, I think it was last year, actually found that after adjusting for Oregon's demographics, we're not getting very much for the extra spending we're doing in our K-12 system. We look pretty average in terms of results in the K-12 system after adjusting. The Oregon Health Plan, as I mentioned before, did increase the number of people with health insurance relative to some other states, but the demand has also exploded for that service, in part because we have very restrictive insurance regulations, making it hard for individuals to get private coverage, and it's even harder, obviously, for low-income Oregonians. Our anti-road, pro-transit policies haven't kept, again, haven't gotten the results that I think we would want. Our congestion ranking has deteriorated. Our housing costs are now fifth most expensive in the nation, and we have the 41st lowest housing ownership rate in the nation now. The real question, I think, after looking at Dr. Posdina's report, may be less the level of spending as to whether we're getting the services we want in a cost-effective way. In other words, I think a lot of Oregonians may be happy to spend more if they were getting more for their dollars. There are at least two approaches that I would suggest you might consider when you're addressing the results of Dr. Posdina's study. One is to look for more efficient ways of providing the level of services that you and previous legislatures have authorized. Another is to look for ways to move those services out of government where they might be provided more effectively and at lower cost. Dr. Posdina primarily addressed the first report, so let me mention just a couple of his suggestions and then conclude with some principles that you might be able to use both now and in the future as you're dealing with these budget issues. Dr. Posdina is an economist, and he has what he calls the mantra of economists, which is that efficiency requires competition and consumer involvement. And when you have a monopoly, it's very difficult to have good service at a reasonable price. In competitive markets, buyers of goods and services are the sovereigns. They have they choose their vendors and they take their money elsewhere when they're not satisfied. In government, however, we rarely have a choice. When we think the service is shoddy or we think it's too expensive, we might complain, but we really can't take our business elsewhere. The result is almost certainly, again from an economic standpoint, a lower level of quality and a higher cost for government service than you'd expect in a competitive environment. Here's how Dr. Posdina applied that, what he called the competitive mantra, to a couple of the major areas. And the first is education, which takes the bulk of the general fund budget. And again, I'll quote him liberally here as he talked about his report. These quotes are not in the report itself, but from a talk that he gave when he released the report. In the K through 12 area, the miracle from an economist perspective is that we get anything at all from the system. There is almost no parental or local influence over the school system because power follows funding, and the state now determines funding levels, as we discussed, primarily because of Measure 5. This allows the education lobby to enjoy the opportunity of one-stop lobbying. And though the lobbying is always in the name of the children, the reality is that parents and students are not able to play much of a part in the decision-making process. Teachers are protected by labor agreements, and no public school, however poorly it performs, is ever shut down. There's no serious competition because it's increasingly hard to take your business elsewhere, and the choice of private school requires you to pay both taxes and tuition, which most people can't afford. The system is really run for the system, and that's the only part that's allowed to fail, unfortunately, too often is the student. Another factor in our high education costs, in my opinion, is a previous legislature's misguided requirement of school district consolidation. Contrary to the common wisdom, consolidation does not lead to economies of scale in a non-competitive industry. It's more likely leads to what economists call diseconomies of scale. And I think we're seeing those today in Oregon. Things get more expensive as the agency, the non-competitive agency, gets bigger. It's competition that forces costs down when companies, private companies in the private sector, get bigger. The competition is distinctly lacking in the public school system. So as we consolidate all these small districts in Oregon, and you think you're eliminating a superintendent when you merge two districts, what the research really finds is that you're actually making costs higher because you have fewer, the little competition that you had where people could move almost across the street to get into a different district goes away. The same thing happens with police services, the debate in Multnomah County.
Are you saying the aggregate costs go up?
Yeah.
I mean, you can look at an individual reduction of an administrator's position.
The aggregate
costs.
Yeah. Oh, you'll have some individual savings, sure. But the tendency is, and there's been research done in Oregon versus other states in the past and other public agencies where we, where some other states encouraged consolidation of like water districts and this sort of thing where Oregon didn't. And you can see the trends where the consolidated districts in other states, the cost went up compared to Oregon. The debate in Multnomah County over consolidating police services. Excuse me.
So you're talking about one of the problems is funding is coming from the state level, but the budgeting is actually done at the local level. We're just a pass-through agency by and large. I mean, doesn't that...
Tell that to Jim Scherzinger today in Portland. I mean, he doesn't have much control over how much money he has because the bulk of it is coming from the state.
And he has control of how it's budgeted.
Right, right.
And that's actually where it is.
But that's an interesting discussion because I was listening to everybody's best friend, Lars Larson, the other day. But he had somebody, the National School Boards Association, came out with some policy directive suggesting that school board members should not micromanage the schools and should limit their role in other words, there's apparently some fellow in Beaverton School District who has the audacity to believe that he actually represents a constituent group and therefore should ask relevant questions, you know, considering how the school actually functions, who's being beaten down for having asked those questions or a series of mm-hmm. questions. We had a similar situation with Sally LaValle and another lady in the Park Rose School District who had the audacity to ask, you know, kind of probing questions, and they were unfortunately the brunt of political, you know, scrutiny and criticism and basically run out of town on a rail for having the audacity to ask questions. So I question whether or not many school board members have the ability to ask and or receive information relevant to the decisions they make.
Do we at the state level?
No, and that's why we keep repeating that. That's why I don't support term limits, quite frankly, because I think term limits simply exacerbate that whole problem. It makes it much more difficult for legislators to really be here long enough who have at least the mindset to probe. You know, because 6 years after you're here, you're gone out the door, and the bureaucracy continues to exist as it did before, and as you say, growing, I think, in aggregate.
I wonder if it doesn't vary by school districts. So
well, it may
vary. I think a lot of school districts have a lot of control over what happens.
Yeah.
Some don't. So sometimes you have a strong superintendent and the school district sort of goes along with the superintendent. Other times you have a strong board and the superintendent finds that the board is helping to make the decisions.
I think those are interesting organizational questions. They occur in private business too, what the role the board should have versus the management. But the difference is, again, that in the private sector, if the board is not operating properly of, say, Fred Meyer, I don't have to put up with the stale bread on the shelf. I can walk across the street to Safeway. I don't have to go to the board meeting of Fred Meyer, see all these people that are at the board meetings of public school districts because they don't have much of a choice. They're trying to make an impact. They're trying to improve their child's education, and they have very little impact because most of the choices aren't even being made at that level. They're being made here and even higher, which I'll get into in a moment.
So that brings another question on is the accountability issue, and we have a Department of Education that has a budget of about $275 million, total budget of about $1 billion. Well, that's pass-through money, federal money is coming through. I know there's some debt service involved with that $275 million, but we're talking about accountability at the state level, and really, if I want to know how my child's doing, I'm going to call a teacher up. I'm not going to call Stan Bunham. And so, from my viewpoint, if you're looking at administrating an agency, what's administration cost? 6% or something like that, rather than 27 or 28% that appears that is coming out of that Department of Education? I mean, do you guys do any stuff on those lines?
We're looking at that right now. It's very hard to determine, you know, things like that because, again, of mandates. For example, the testing requirements, and the federal government has just put on massive new testing requirements that are going to have to be handled at the state level. So how much of that is administrative versus accountability versus, you know, other factors? It gets very, very muddy.
Yeah. It gets interesting too with the federal government education too, because in some sense it's probably better to tell the government, this federal government, to stick it, because based on the amount of money they actually invest in the state and the cost of actually complying with their proposals is sometimes ludicrous.
That's right in one of the principles there in front of you. Yes.
We could go back to the 1830s before we had any public education at all. We had all private education. The thing was that most kids didn't get any education at all because they couldn't afford the private ed. And the fact that Massachusetts started the movement toward public education has really been a boon for this country, I think.
Well, if you believe that, Senator, that doesn't mean that the government has to actually build the buildings and provide the teachers. If it provided the funding,
there are a lot of different ways of doing it over time, but we've educated a lot of kids and pretty well, and a lot of them made real contributions to the country over the years through the public system. It helped us with a whole immigrant population that needed to learn about America and become American, and I think it worked really very well generally.
It does raise question about competition, though, too. I mean, being a policeman for as many years as in the last 10 years I've been a detective, there's a lot of money to be made doing investigations outside of law enforcement, outside of government. I mean, quite honestly, there are organizations that will pay very good money to have competent investigations done.
Well, not just investigations. I think, as you know, there are now, I believe, it's twice as many non-sworn public protection employees in the country as sworn police officers.
Well, actually,
there's a demand for that service.
With fraud investigations, one of the phenomena that's going on right now, because we're incarcerating a lot of violent offenders, violent personal offenders, but the fraud crimes are growing exponentially. And if you want to actually do something about it, you're probably far better off to have your own private investigator who's competent do the investigation, collate it, and present it to the district attorney in a way they can understand so they can prosecute it. And it's just as good as the public agency, because the public agencies aren't doing the investigations at all. They can't justify it.
And talking about, again, accountability, there's always this question of accountability, and I think the people, from my point of view, that the system really should be accountable to in education are the parents and the children. And too often it seems that the accountability flows between government agencies, between the federal government, the state government, school district, between the board and the superintendent. Our public school system is saturated with accountability. There are public school board meetings every day. There are, you know, you can go in person or you can watch on cable TV. Everybody has their say, but the individual students are really captive to what the collective decisions are. Where again, in a private market, either competitive schools or in the private sector in other fields, you don't have to wait for those collective decisions. There are a lot of different options, and you can choose the options that are best for your family. And then all I'm saying is that in addition to that, I think being more accountability, it also is more cost effective. Even if it is public dollars that are paying for that education, that's the way to hold costs down in education so you don't get in these problems of we have to cut $100 million from the school budget to, in this case, now to balance the budget. We've said enough probably about education at this point. On health care, Dr. Pozina, some very interesting points. And again, Oregon being in the forefront of a rationing plan for health care. Nationwide, our health care now takes up about 14% of our gross domestic product. And economists argue that these health policies, the kind of government health policies that Oregon has adopted and others, have really perverted health insurance to the point that it's functioning more like a tax scheme than an insurance scheme. I want to just clarify that a little bit because I think it's really very important as you talk about what happens to the Oregon health plan. The economic purpose of insurance is to protect us from the cost of unexpected serious events. Yet we insure completely normal, predictable events in healthcare like coughs and flus, that the cost of normal pregnancies, for example, the things that virtually everybody is going to have and you know you're going to have, we handle it through the insurance system. Think about if we handled the same sort of thing through our automobile insurance. If we had automobile insurance like the Oregon Health Plan or even like a lot of our private insurance, the automobile insurance would cover not only accidents, which you can't anticipate and which can be very serious, but your weekly gas fill-ups, your oil changes, your 3,000-mile tune-ups, your tires. You know, it would cover all that stuff that you know you're going to have when you purchase that automobile. And what do you think would happen to the cost of insurance if you did that? It would go through the roof. That's what's happened, basically, with health insurance.
Mr. Chair?
Senator.
Let me make sure I understand. So you're saying that us paying for preventative health care is more expensive than people going directly to emergency rooms for what could have been prevented. Is that what you're saying?
Not necessarily preventative. You're talking about checkups or mammograms, for example, that sort of thing.
Mammograms is a really good example.
Yeah. If they're a regular thing that people should have, and I know what you're saying is that if people don't have those, it can become much more expensive on the other end. Yes, I'm saying that the way we handle insurance now is not the best way to handle that. The better way to handle that, in my opinion and Dr. Plazina's opinion, is through a program, something like medical savings accounts, where you have a catastrophic plan, health insurance plan, with a very high deductible, but you have the money available. In other words, you as a legislature can allocate funds so they still have the money for the mammograms, but if they manage their money well, they can actually save that money as you can in the private sector, and you only use the insurance portion for catastrophic events. You save all the paperwork of having to deal with the insurance company. You save all the administrative costs in the doctor's office. Right there, you can save quite a lot if you handle it through, in effect, a cash basis or a credit card account.
Didn't we do something similar to that in workers' compensation law? And I'm trying to remember where we did something with the employer doing some out-of-pocket expense coverage for minor injuries rather than...
No. Aware of that.
It's been a long time, but there was some proposal that we did in workers' compensation where the employer could cover certain costs out of pocket and then get the employee back to work, and they would avoid some of the cost implications. It's been a long time since we've had that discussion. So. And the idea was to lower the premium because you weren't involving them in the insurance.
Mm-hmm.
You weren't making a claim, per se. You were literally diverting these people out by the employer paying the cost out of pocket up to a certain level. So, Senator,
I guess I appreciate your analogy. I'm just not sure that paying or not paying for a mammogram in terms of preventing breast cancer is the same thing as having your oil filter changed and preventing an accident. I'm not sure the analogy is parallel there. I hear what you're saying, but I'm not sure the analogy is quite.
It probably isn't exactly correct. But again, you want to go through all the paperwork. Again, the paperwork raises the cost. And if you have predictable events, it shouldn't be paid through an insurance system, is what I'm saying. There are better, more cost-effective ways to handle it that also give some responsibility back to the patient. Because of the way we're handling health insurance in this country now, that we spawned a system of managed care, which everybody at first thought was great, and they thinks is terrible. And you know, it sort of comes full circle. And yet in Oregon, it's very difficult to get medical savings accounts, even if you can afford them, because of our insurance laws. The companies don't want to come here because it's too difficult to get them approved. And you'll see a lot of people who, because of our restrictive insurance regulations, especially lower income people, are forced to apply to the Oregon Health Plan, who, if we had high deductible policies with medical savings accounts, could have afforded health insurance in the private sector. So you're, because of the insurance end, you're actually creating a demand that's causing you trouble on the budget in the Oregon Health Plan.
Can I, Mr. Chair? Is there a study or report, some documentation that gives us the information, the conclusion that you just stated?
On a national level, yes.
Related to Oregon?
No, not that I'm aware of. Basically, we're looking at nationwide what happens. You look at health insurance rates in other states where you can get savings accounts, and the lower cost, and you assume that, you know, if we had that lower cost here in Oregon, that you'd have people who right now can't afford health insurance who could afford it.
Okay, then that's a piece that is really important for us to hear, that your statement is really based on an assumption, that it's not backed up by any factual. And I'm not
Oregon,
trying to
yes.
put
no,
you on
right.
the start, on,
right.
on the spot. I think it's important that we deal with hard information here that we can relate to the reality of our state. And when you talk about the health plan and a person's ability to either pay for the health plan or be eligible for the health plan and or pay for a medical savings account, there's a piece in that equation that you didn't mention, and that's having employment. Having some form of employment that pays enough that would allow a person to invest in a medical savings account, along with paying for housing, paying for child care, paying for, you know, the list of all the other expenditures.
Right. In my analogy, you'd be looking at people who were employed who had the ability to buy health insurance if it was affordable, who otherwise, you know, depend on the Oregon Health Plan, of course. Somebody doesn't have income, but it doesn't matter how cheap the insurance is.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We invest about $2.4 billion in the general fund in the Oregon Health Plan. And anecdotally, I suppose every one of us have heard from health carriers or health care providers that there is a reason for us to look harder at how the health care delivery system works. In some cases, there's clearly overutilization of the healthcare services, people routinely going in for fairly minor issues. But that's, in my opinion, it's got to be balanced against the idea that folks that get regular physicals are far more likely to experience early detection of cancers and heart disease, which are the two leading causes of serious and catastrophic illnesses in Oregon. And for instance, under one of the health care plans that's offered to state employees, there's a choice, there's a menu, a cafeteria plan for different deductibles. And it can be $200 per family member, and there's, I think, $1,000 per family. And the details vary from plan to plan. There's also an incentive payment for annual physicals. I think you get $75 or some measurable amount of money to incent for physicals. And I guess that's aimed at the early detection issue. But anecdotally, I hear a lot from healthcare providers that the Oregon Health Plan particularly has not solved the problem of people making fairly expensive drop-in visits under the Oregon Health Plan. So the element that was aimed at was programmatical preventative healthcare. I'm not sure we got there. But there's not much auditing going on in the Oregon Health Plan so that we know. You know, it's a lightly administered program. The Secretary of State's audits have shown that maybe we ought to really implement some more close scrutiny of how that plan is actually delivering services. But what's also at this issue, and maybe you'll address this question, is that when somebody does encounter a health problem, even under the Oregon Health Plan, they're sent on this bewildering, dizzying series of referrals to specialists and there may be 4 and 5 different opinions offered before a course of treatment's decided on. And that has more to do with the lack of tort reform than it has to do with services to the citizen or the client under the Oregon Health Plan. Doctors are terrified that if they misdiagnose or miss a diagnosis, that what happens to them is that they go to the cleaners. And the cost of medical malpractice insurance, if you track it over the few years, is pretty serious.
It's going up about 30%.
In escalation. That's a big part of the cost of the insurance. So, you know, at the risk of becoming a high candidate for the multiple mailings of the community, the legal community, and this issue, I think we really need to look at all the components that add up to the cost centers in providing health care, how it's used, who are the clients, get some accountability into the Oregon Health Plan, but also look at the cost drivers for the healthcare delivery systems themselves. Hospitals are experiencing terrifying effects in terms of liability, and doctors, nurse practitioners, midwives even now are being told that they have the same overheads and liabilities as surgeons, when in fact they do not generally take complicated cases. They'll refer those to the physician community, and the kinds of midwifery practices are usually normal births, uncomplicated births, but their medical malpractice is putting them out of business. So, you know, that whole system, it isn't just the insurance cost, it's all the drivers around it. And I don't think we've been willing to sit down and look at all the component pieces. And until we do that, I think we're just going to be on a 20 to 30% escalator on a biennial basis. Not something we can afford to keep doing.
All right. Senator?
Every 2 years we go through the mandate exercise, special interest groups, okay. Both sides coming in saying we should be doing this, should be doing that. So what you're saying basically is that the mandating that we do from government is bad, or it causes whatever it is, in writing of the policies makes it more expensive? Is that the
point? In many cases, I think, yes. Not always. I mean, obviously, if you're providing the money, there's got to be some, as you pointed out, you know, accountability in some way that it's used. The problems that Senator Ferriello you're pointing out are endemic in the healthcare industry, whether it's the Oregon Health Plan or private insurance or private pay. I don't think it matters where the money comes from. We could talk about those issues, but those, you know, I have no expertise in the tort reform issue, and you're subject to the same problems with Oregon Health Plan patients as, you know, Blue Cross private patients are. But I think we lose a lot of flexibility with those mandates. I mean, we issued 2 reports, Cascade Policy Institute did, after the Oregon Health Plan came out, questioning the very concept of the way it was put together. The rationing plan itself, we think, is faulty, and that's maybe something for another day. But once you have it in place, because of the waivers you get from the federal government of how to use the Medicaid money, it's very difficult to change, as I understand. You can't even change the line like you want it to.
Well, I think that's really a moot discussion anyway. I don't think that line truly exists as it did theoretically when the program.
No, it didn't save any money, according to our analysis. The reality is it's actually cost more. The theory was that you have a limited number of dollars and you want to ration those dollars, which in your own family budget, that's called budgeting, you know. But in the Oregon Health Plan, it's called rationing, and even a lot of our supporters thought it was a good idea. I mean, you know, taxpayers don't want to spend frivolously on the health care for people who can't afford the health care, but the reality, I think, is that it hasn't worked out that way, and it hasn't really been a cost saver. And I think it's actually had some negative consequences to health care in addition to the rising cost. And we feel... I think a lot of economists feel that you really need to put more personal responsibility back into the hands of the patient. And if they don't have the money and you want to allocate from the public funds the money, that's one thing, just like public education. But don't put all the mandates on how they use it and make the doctors and the patients, in effect, lie about what treatment they're getting so they can get covered, you know, above the line. It leads to, I think, less personal responsibility when you do that. As an example, and with Senator Ferriero's question, I don't have the answer to this part of it, but Hong Kong and Singapore have gone to a virtually a medical savings account model for all their citizens. Now, in their case, at least Singapore, it's mandatory, which I would disagree with. But when you look at the difference, Singapore, which is a fairly wealthy country, has comparable health outcomes to ours, and yet we pay 14% nationwide of our GDP for health care. They pay 4%. And again, a large part of that, and maybe not all of it, is due to the fact that most routine health care is paid for out of pocket in Singapore, and the insurance only covers the catastrophic events. I'm not sure how they handle the legal situation. They probably have less problem than we do.
Well, Oregon has a particular problem with the tort reform issue, and Senator Brown, I'm kind of looking to you. There was a fairly recent Oregon Supreme Court decision that lifted the tort reform and the tort liability limitation. Just a year or so ago, and it, because of that, a lot of these medical malpractice insurance premiums are going up, and I've heard as much as 30% and 40%. So that's something that's kind of an underlying theme because of that. And there's actually, I've been told, another case that may affect all public employees, that they may have the exposure, you know, personally, and it's a whole question of what. To what level the state can indemnify them as a liability for actions as the public employees, which may change law enforcement as we know it today. So, interesting.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Yeah, just a comment on our discussion thus far, and really appreciate you being here to help us with this part of our discussion. A couple of pieces are troubling to me around our discussion of the Oregon Health Plan, and I think it goes to the question of values and, you know, what do we value as Oregonians as we look at the overall well-being of all of our people. And with that said, I would also say that I'm one who believes that health care is a right, or should be considered a right, and that we should try to reach some level of access to health care for all of our people. In the end, that serves the greater good. In the end, there's a lot less other expenses. You know, if we were to set that out there as a goal. And then my other comment is just it's kind of a comment on your use of the comparison to, was it Singapore?
Yes, Singapore and Hong Kong.
And comparing their health care outcomes to health care outcomes in the United States. There's a flaw in that in this country, which also is reflected in our state, we're still struggling with huge disparities in healthcare access and actual delivery of services to women, to people of color. I don't know that you can accurately do that comparison with Singapore and the experience that we have here in this nation and in this state. So. Again, I'm just troubled by the piece that has to do with our values. What are our values as a people, an Oregon people? How do we serve the greater good? How do we deal with that reality that is a great deal of poverty in our state, people who cannot afford to pay for health care? And so then what is the public responsibility, not burden, but responsibility to be our brother and sister's keeper, if you will.
Could you clarify something for me, the comment you made with respect to huge disparities with women and minority in health care?
Mm-hmm.
Can you kind of expand on that a little bit?
Well, we could probably together give you
it's a serious question.
Yeah, I know it is, and I appreciate it. The governor of our state appointed a racial and ethnic health task force by executive order back in 2000. That task force is looking at the inequities in healthcare access in a number of areas, HIV, AIDS, diabetes, mental health, just go down the line. We have a history of not adequately serving certain populations in our state. And the same is true for population of women. We've had a women's health and wellness task force focused on legislative initiatives the past, what, three sessions?
10 years.
Four sessions, longer than that. And we've had to use that other approach, the Women's Health and Wellness Task Force and the Senate and the governor's executive order approach, because these populations have not historically been adequately served through public policy. That's a partial answer.
Yeah, and I'm kind of fascinated, because I've been following the implementation of Senate Bill 819, and it's interesting to me that what you're saying, and even though the governor, you know, has this task force, some of the policies or the administrative rules that are being drafted to implement 819 run counter to what you're telling me. It's kind of fascinating. So.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
I think there's a real specific example that you can look at that tends to reinforce what our colleagues are saying. Women for decades were far behind men in terms of heart disease and high blood pressure, hypertensive disease. Well, they're closing the gap, you know, as more women are in the workforce and pursue careers more like the careers traditionally held by men, and stress and demand. And so the rates of heart disease and high blood pressure and hypertensive disorders are climbing. But according to the statistics that come out of the healthcare community, they're less likely to be diagnosed with hypertensive disorders or high blood pressure or heart disease, and less likely to get early treatment for those diseases. And nobody's quite sure whether it's a mindset that women don't have these kinds of disorders, or it's lack of diagnostics. I mean, there are some physiological differences.
But probably because there's a lot of male doctors out there that don't believe fibromyalgia exists.
Well, you know, up until very recently, clinical trials were white males.
And he studied breast cancer in white males for a long time, you guys. And I know that white men get breast cancer, but yeah. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, that's simply because white males are more closely associated with the physiology of white laboratory rats.
That is interesting.
I mean, Mr. Chair, the issue of, I mean, we've worked really hard for 10 years to get insurance companies to require, insurance companies to cover contraceptives. And while you may or may not agree with contraceptives, I can tell you that a huge portion of the women out there from sometime between the ages of 20 and 50 use them at some period in their lives. And it's very interesting to me that we won't win at the legislature, we will win in the courts, because companies that provide prescription drug coverage that don't cover contraceptive benefits clearly are being found by the courts to be discriminating on the basis of gender.
But let's get back to the discussion about MSAs, for instance, whether we're talking contraceptives or just general coverage. I mean, I kind of see a benefit, and I want to explore this a little bit, because the union that I happen to be a member of is currently discussing the cost of health care for law enforcement, because as many other public agencies, we're experiencing these, you know, exponentially high costs. And our folks are looking at it and saying, look, if you look at the usage of law enforcement officers in health care procedures, we're net contributors to the total cost, so we want to segregate ourselves out, which is very interesting, because what that shows us is that law enforcement people have a tendency, not always, but to try to be healthier in terms of their, you know, they work out, they weightlifting and things of this nature, but they're basically, they don't use as much health care service as many of the other public sector employees within at least the city of Portland. So their idea is, well, let's segregate ourselves out. But it gets to the question of, if you had a medical savings account or some way of motivating all public employees, for instance, or all employees in general, to I guess, be engaged in their health care,
to that extent, you may ultimately be able to theoretically, and if an MSA gives you the ability to choose when you can and cannot get services, or what you can and cannot get those services for, and the decisions are yours as opposed to your healthcare provider, to some level, that seems to make a certain amount of sense. I mean, obviously, you need catastrophic healthcare, mm-hmm. but it really should be an individual choice. But I don't know the nuances of that. I know the Portland Police Association just voted to approve a thing called VEBA, which is it's a medical healthcare thing that allows retirees to take their sick time and put it into a program that's tax exempt until the money's come out and it's taxed. And it's dedicated specifically to healthcare. So I don't know the nuances of all the taxes.
It's complex. Medical savings accounts allow you can roll over the cash portion tax-free as you go along. You can roll it into long-term care insurance, which is another problem. I'm not sure about retirement. Again, since we're not allowed at our firm to have one, I haven't looked that closely into all the details. And talking about the mandates, I mean, respectfully disagree that, well, yes, contraceptives are necessary for a lot of people. Breast exams obviously are necessary. When you pile mandate on top of mandate on top of mandate, you price a lot of people, again, on national studies, out of health insurance. And you see a lot of young people, employed people, choosing rationally, in my view, not to buy health insurance because it's so expensive. And then they can become a public burden if something catastrophic happens to them. I would prefer giving people more personal responsibility and allowing MSAs and other high deductible policies so that more people could afford catastrophic insurance, and let them be more responsible for even preventative health care. And they may make wrong decisions. It may not work for everybody. But I think as a people, you're talking, Senator Gordley, about our values, letting people choose what they do with their own bodies and choose what they do with their own lives, I think, is a value too. And you can supply the same amount of money through the legislative process for health care for the poor in Oregon, but I'm very confident that through using medical savings accounts and other high deductible policies and eliminating a lot of the mandates, you could insure a whole lot more people for the same amount of money. And where does that fit into the values? I mean, it's always, there are always trade-offs, but I think giving people some respect and allowing them to make some of their own decisions, talking about all the referrals, that's the gatekeeper process which spawned that, I think, in HMOs. A lot of people are rebelling against that. Mm-hmm. I know when my parents got sick a couple of years ago and were in an HMO, you know, I was the one that had to go and basically get around all that because they never would have gotten to the specialist they needed mm-hmm. if we'd had to, if they'd had to deal with all that. And I think you have to give people more individual freedom within whatever program you're funding, whether it's education or healthcare.
So are you suggesting, if I'm following this correctly, that with some of the programs, the audiences that receive and qualify for the Oregon Health Plan, for instance, rather than having an insurance product, you actually would allocate a certain amount of resource in a medical savings account to that population and give them those individuals the ability to choose?
You can still give them a choice. In other words, if you have a whole, just like the cafeteria plan and all the different plans that Senator Farrelly was talking about for public employees, you can have the same thing, and as I understand it in the Oregon Health Plan now, you're coming down to just one provider. The providers are dropping out because, whether it's true or not, they feel they're not making money on the Oregon Health Plan.
I've heard it's not just that they're not making money, but it's actually dealing with the paperwork and just the administrative process.
Well, paperwork costs money, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very expensive, and we held a program here in Salem a couple weeks ago and in Portland on a program called Simple Care, which is another way for low-income individuals to get reduction on their health care costs basically by paying cash. Very simple concept that you go into the average doctor or hospital and ask what's the cash cost of this procedure, and they have no idea because they have these armies of people in the back room who do all the paperwork. Oops, sorry about that. All the paperwork for the insurance companies. They don't know what the cost of their services are. And I think if we get back to that, if we have some competition in health care, just like in education, whatever dollars you allocate for public health will go a lot farther.
So how would somebody with, I have a friend who's got MS and she's in a wheelchair, I mean, how would she end up dealing with a medical savings account? I mean, I assume her monthly medical costs are very high. And then I guess my other question for you is the whole idea of competition and creating winners and losers, and I'm probably more in the Senator Gorley's corner that, you know, healthcare is a right for people, and that if we have people who are losers, I mean, what are we going to do? What happens if somebody, you know, chooses to spend their MSA frivolously or whatever, and we just throw them out in the street? I mean, do they just not have healthcare, I guess? So,
I think it's not really the lifeboat analogy, but you know, there are always hard cases. But, you know, you're looking at public policy for all Oregonians, and I think you have to assume, I hope you assume, that the average Oregonian, that most Oregonians can make good decisions about their own lives. I mean, with all due respect, they elected you. They're voting for policies, they're voting for legislators, they're living their lives, and the more we give them the chance to do that in areas where they haven't had it, like healthcare, I think we'll be better off. Again, you'll have more money available to help the hard cases if you can save money on everybody else.
Interesting economic experiment. If they actually gave the resources to the individuals and they then had the choice to go wherever, interesting to see if there's a competitive dynamic with physicians and nurse practitioners and other licensed healthcare professionals to provide the services.
There's a real debate about whether that would happen, and some people think that healthcare is different, that you wouldn't, the competition wouldn't lead to cost savings. I disagree with that, but even if it is true, simply getting rid of the paperwork, 85% of doctor visits are for routine care, not for catastrophic events. So for 85% of healthcare interactions, you could do away with insurance and have a medical savings account, and the cost, just the administrative cost of administering those 85% of the visits on a cash basis instead of dealing with insurance companies, will save a lot of money. Doing it in other states, just because you can afford, the doctor can take a $60 visit, I think, a $60 visit, and knock it down to a $40 visit because he doesn't have that $20 in insurance costs.
Anybody doing this?
Yeah. The Simple Care program is going on. I think it's, don't hold me to the numbers, but the McMinnville Physicians Association, out of, I think, 68 doctors, something like 65 of them have signed up for Simple Care to basically reduce their costs, basically giving their best cost to cash payers. That's not an MSA. Again, most people in Oregon are not allowed to have an MSA, but it's a way to reduce the cost when you pay cash. And in other states, California, for example, and a number of other states where insurance regulations are less restrictive than Oregon, MSAs have reduced the cost of health insurance for many people dramatically.
So if public sector unions could formulate some kind of agreements with physicians groups to do Simple Care,
sure,
proposed, couldn't they?
Sure.
And reduce their costs. Interesting.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, the city of Portland is self-insured, at least to the police and fire. So, interesting ideas. See, we have to transition and get this fellow from the population research
center. Let me just conclude by saying that I gave you one other document, which is the 7 principles of state budget reform that we released in 1993. So the numbers are all off. They're all much bigger, obviously. The all funds budget, I think, is triple what it was back then, something like that. But principles, I think, are still very valid. And if you want to take a look at those, I know, I'm sure none of you will agree with all of them. I don't even necessarily agree with all of them. But they're very thought-provoking. And the final one, just to mention, Senator Minnis, your comment about the strings that come with federal money. There are strings that come with state money down to the local level. And I had an example of that the other day in a local Oregon school district where the PE benchmarks have now been put in place and I guess were voted on or at least authorized by the legislature last year. And they're basically requiring districts now to assess students on their ability to hop, skip, and jump, and there's some other things in there. And you get a small district that doesn't even have PE teachers, and the burden, just the time burden, along with all the other testing burdens, is quite a bit, and I don't think you're compensating for that. So the straitjackets go from the federal government to the state, mm-hmm. but also from the state to local governments, and you might just be aware of that.
I'm trying to remember, when did we do that?
That was Senator Courtney's effort, and it was last session, I believe.
They were implemented in June of last year. Yeah, and that's the first one, is the hop, skip, and jump, and the ability to stop and start on command for third graders. And again, very simple things, but when you have to actually document, that's just one out of 5 pages worth of benchmarks in new PE, and that's not all the other subjects, mm-hmm. and we can talk about assessment and testing, but that one has caused some consternation in some of the school districts.
Yeah, I'm thinking about the cost of having me qualify four times a month with my Glocks. That's a challenge.
Mr. Chair, I happened to watch a bit of Oprah yesterday. My husband was homesick in bed, and I came home early, but...
Are you taking care of him?
No, I'm a horrible nurse. Not that it would surprise anybody here. But a fellow by the name of Dean Ornish was on talking about the obesity epidemic that's basically going through the country. And I can't remember if this is quite the statistic, but it's like 70% of 13-year-olds are obese. I mean, it's a huge epidemic. So the free market may be working, but we're going to be paying health care costs in about 10 years as these young people start having huge heart problems. So,
Actually, I just finished a class, a medical anthropology class, and the instructor from Eastern was telling us that in Japan, that their health care changed dramatically when McDonald's opened up.
Right, exactly.
10 years after being there, they're now seeing the same kind of phenomena that we see in health care, disease, et cetera. So free enterprise does have sometimes its...
It has some downsides, yes. I think you just have to look at the overall, giving people more freedom rather than less is a good thing.
I do think PE is a good thing, however.
It certainly is. I have a request, and that is, I don't know how many more of these committee meetings we have scheduled, but I'd really like to spend some more time with Mr. Busting and the Cascade Policy Institute. I had kind of fast-forwarded from this and started on this document, and I would really like to see our committee spend some more time on discussing and debating these essential and debatable roles that government should or should not be playing. Again, given the charge of this committee, it just seems to me that we have an opportunity to spend some more time with a group of folks who devoted a lot of energy to coming up with ideas and proposals for our consideration.
Good.
And I know that's a strange suggestion coming from
the... Well, I'll just mention briefly that's the first principle we have there, is basically determine your core businesses.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the legislature has moved somewhat in that direction this last session, and the special session is looking at not just across the board cuts, but actually making some value judgments about which programs are important. But I would argue, and I'd be glad to come back to discuss going a step further and basically saying we can't be everything to everybody. We have certain needs. Are there programs that not just we can cut 8% or 10%, but we can eliminate? We can find other ways that Oregonians can get those services outside of the budgeting process of the state of Oregon.
And part of it, too, is just challenging ourselves to think differently.
Yes.
Because, we get in this public sector, private sector, Portland public school system's going through this now. Do we contract out for custodial care? Well, frankly, I don't know whether the answer is yes or no. Will you actually receive a better product, or you have a better employee, or ultimately whether it works or not? But I think having the discussion and the conversation is in and of itself, to some extent, competition, because public employees, like myself, from time to time, need to evaluate whether or not the services that we provide are really kind of meeting the test of what the public expects from us. So.
And frankly, Mr. Chair, the discussion I want to get to and have more of is the safety net for those in need, which is listed as one of the essential services in the Cascade Policy Institute document. Whatever we do or neglect with those who are most vulnerable becomes our Achilles heel.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever else we say we want to accomplish,
right,
as a state, that's our challenge.
Yeah. I think it's fascinating to me in politics. People ask me, "So, what made the biggest difference in you becoming who you are today in the politics?" And it's like, well, the facts. My philosophy was confronted with the facts. So I had a certain set of beliefs when I came into the system, which were X. And then when you're kind of confronted with the facts, you kind of go, "Well, you know what? That philosophy maybe doesn't fit quite the way I thought it did."
Mm-hmm.
And I think really all of us have to be mature enough to adjust based on what we know, and to the extent that we have certain level of knowledge, we also have an accountability responsibility to make good decisions. So that's why discussions like this, I think, are good, even with people who we find that we disagree with. I think having those challenges are important. All right? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
All right.
This is about 5 minutes, Mr. Chair.
5 minutes.
Break.